Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. My name is Judith Koch. I'm a PhD student and the production manager of this podcast. Please welcome today's host, Vinet Thakur, lecturer in international relations at the Institute of History at Leiden University and board member of the EISA.
Hello and welcome to this edition of EISA's podcast, Voices. If you study or teach IR, have you ever looked into your course syllabi and ever counted the number of women in the course reading list? I have done it a few times, and I think it is fairly uncontroversial to say that those are populated predominantly by men. Why is that so? Is it because women have historically been excluded from the task of knowledge production in general, and more specifically in our discipline? Or is their marginalization a product of active silencing and neglect in disciplinary practices? In general, where are the women in the history of international thought? And this question is in some ways ironical because the term international thought itself was coined by a woman, Florence Millien Stabile. Now, some of these questions are raised in the Leverhulme project titled Women and the History of International Thought, which is led by a formidable team of leading IR scholars, Patricia Owens, Katharina Ritzler, Kimberly Hutchings, and Sarah Denston. This project retrieves the intellectual contributions of women to international thought and is in a true sense a gift to the discipline. They have by now published 2 edited volumes, several journal articles, multiple special sections and roundtables, and a public exhibition in London. And there's plenty more to come, including a monograph and a doctoral dissertation. So we're very glad and excited to have today with us the principal investigator of this project, Professor Patricia Owens. Professor Owens teaches at the University of Oxford, and her works span a wide range of interests, including 20th century international history and theory, historical and contemporary practices of Anglo-American counterinsurgency and military intervention, and disciplinary history and the history of international and political thought. This is such an exciting project in general, Patricia. Thank you so very much for taking out the time to talk to us on this episode of What is Women in International Thought?
Thanks. It's lovely to be with you.
Could we start with, you briefly telling us about how you came to your project about women in international thought and about your characterization of what you call historical women in these volumes?
Sure. Well, my first book that came out of my PhD, although my PhD wasn't on this thinker, was on Hannah Arendt's international thought. That book came out in 2007. I wasn't really thinking of Arendt as a sort of woman thinker. I mean, I was obviously conscious of her positionality, but that wasn't central to how I was thinking about her. In fact, I was quite resistant to that. Fast forward to 2015, but because of that book, I was invited to a workshop in London organized by 3 historians, Valeska Huber, Tamsin Peach, and Katharina Ritzler, who was then a colleague of mine at Sussex, an historian, to have a conversation about women's absence in international intellectual history. And that workshop really was sparked by the work of Glenda Sluger. There was a particular sort of moment in 2015 where Glenda Sluger was mounting this critique of David Armitage's recent book on international intellectual history and the absence of women thinkers in that context, but also the publication of 2 other really, I think, now landmark texts, I think. One is a book called Toward an Intellectual History of Black Women, edited by Mia Bay, Farah Griffin, Martha Jones, and Barbara Savage. And also, of course, better known to in an IR context is Bob Vitalis's 2015 book, White World Order, Black Power Politics. And there was this sense that now there was this kind of new and better way of thinking about the past of international thought and of disciplinary history. And so these conversations sort of spiraled. We carried them on at a Radcliffe Exploratory Seminar in 2018. And we Katerina and I, in particular, working together at Sussex, thought that there was this sort of makings here of a sort of exciting new research project around women and the history of international thought. And we decided to approach Kim Hutchings as the sort of leading feminist political, international political theorist to sort of kind of balance the different kinds of international relations expertise that we had, and put together the project as a sort of collaborative and interdisciplinary project. So that's the sort of context and sort of early story of the project. In terms of our characterization of historical women, it's really intended to convey sort of two things about our main subjects. First is periodization. You know, we're interested in historical figures writing about international relations before really the re-emergence of feminist IR in the 1980s. So we want our main Fiat period is for a 20th century project, but it's the early to long mid 20th century. So in that sense, it's a sort of periodization, but in some sense, more importantly, in a way, it also indicates that we're thinking of the category of women in a non-essentialist, non-biological way. It's as a discursive, intersectional, historical construct. I prefer historical to social because my second book project is a sort of critique of sociological, social thinking. So I personally much prefer, I think we can say anything we want to say with the term historical that we do say with the term social. So it's an historical construct. But, you know, these figures that we're interested in, these historical thinkers, were constituted as and read as women. And so we recognize with this category, what's at stake in thinking about them as women thinkers is thinking about the effects of the gender binary on the content and reception of their work, and indeed on all the entire history of international thought, quote unquote, men as much as women. So I think the challenge is to recognize that, but without reifying and essentializing, making exclusive gender categories. And so in some sense, it's a project that draws on sort of women's history and feminist history methods, but it's also a 21st century project in the sense that, you know, we have a better and different understanding now about the category and the contested and still in Britain, political fight over this category of women.
Thanks very much, Patricia. Your book is about recovery and retrieval, but it's also about critique of sort of mainstream IR, which is, like I said, sort of populated almost wholly by men. Could you first sort of lay out for us what is the problem with the IR canon, with this narrow characterization of IR canon?
Yeah, so we have different strands of the project. This strand on sort of canon, on the canon and canonical thinkers is a part of the project that Kim Hutchings and I are working on. We have one article out together on sort of this question, and Kim is doing more work on this as well. I mean, there are so many issues with having a canon in a field as relatively recent as, or any field really, but a canon as relatively recent as international relations, being solely comprised of white men, and white men from a very particular, you know, from Britain or the United States and some emigre Europeans. These points have been made, the kinds of points we're making have been made for decades in other fields. Well, let's leave aside the question whether we should have canons at all, but even if we accept that we may want to have, there's some inevitable canon construction in any attempt to form and legitimize an academic discipline. I mean, one methodological problem is raised by historians of thought, which is that canons falsely present a picture of a kind of continuous tradition of thinking on a subject that never existed. So it's bad intellectual history. That's one problem. If we then get specific about, you know, inquiring into the mechanisms and processes by which an all-male, all-white canon comes about, we see all kinds of racist, nationalistic, misogynist practices that of exclusion that are necessary in order to constitute that canon. So we take the canon itself becomes an object of historical inquiry. How does it become all male or white? I mean, you know, we can find, and we're starting to tell these stories in both volumes about how that came about. And Robert Vitalis, of course, has done this brilliantly in the context of the exclusion of African-American men and women international thinkers in the US context. So it's bad disciplinary history as well. Right. Another problem long raised by feminist and post-colonial critics is that all male, all white canons, they elevate the thought of a really narrow cast of sort of often mediocre white male thinkers at the expense of, you know, brilliant and mediocre thinkers of color, women, people from around the world, and that this limits how we can think about our subject of international relations. And so, you know, it limits the thinking that we can do about international relations today and the kind of field that we present to our students. Kim's also thinking about this question in terms of epistemic justice, and that there are questions about turning to these thinkers as a question of epistemic justice. And I'll leave you to invite Kim up on to talk about that perhaps in another context. But, you know, this is really important ethical and philosophical questions that Kim is, you know, addressing in current and forthcoming work.
A big part of the effort that you make in these two volumes is of recovery, you know, recovery of the thought of international women, historical women. But you also, in your pieces, have suggested that we need to go beyond recovery and think about reconstitution and sometimes even rejection. And to that, you've just mentioned this whole idea of epistemic justice. We could also perhaps, and that's what you've just flagged, think more in terms of representations, not just in terms of gender, but also race, class, and also, like you said, moving beyond gender binaries. And so all of these things are the kinds of things that you flag in your work. Now, how do we, as sort of educators and learners, concretely move towards doing this within the discipline, beyond just the histories that you've done?
I mean, this is a massive question for the field as a whole and for the wider academy, of course. And a lot of people have been thinking about these questions for a long time. So, for example, there's a lot of work now that's been done to sort of decolonize IR curricula. And I think it's increasingly difficult now for current teachers to sort of present syllabi to students who are aware of the world and are thinking and do not have a sort of very narrow sort of ideological blinkers to sort of present any kind of sort of very all male, all white reading list, for example. Now, you know, just putting on a few white women and, you know, tokenistically putting on, you know, one black thinker, for example, or, you know, or sort of one person from the global south, or, you know, one person from this region or that region as a sort of tokenistic exercise, I think is also, and that's often been one approach to this problem and to the demands of students and scholars to decolonize curricula, is obviously also becoming highly being challenged now too. And so I think the people's expectations about what it means to really think about representation is much more profound. I mean, even if we just stick to the sort of very narrow terms of histories of international thoughts or international or global intellectual history, then, you know, I think we need to, you know, IR itself needs to expand its expertise and improve its methods, its language training, and perhaps its own expectations at the graduate level, so that the work is done to put on the syllabus, right? So we can, you know, I think the field itself needs to think about its own standing and its own ability to sort of generate what we might think of as more representative accounts of international relations, histories, and theories. I mean, there's lots of promising initiatives in this regard. Just one relatively new graduate student-led Association for Global Political Thought. You know, it's based at Harvard, but it incorporates a much wider interdisciplinary and international network of scholars. And so that in narrowly within the field that I'm working in, these things are happening. Our experience on the WIT project is that this work can be done quite effectively as collaborative and ideally funded, bring in the funding to and context where graduate students and postdocs are doing work and gaining the expertise to actually do this work. I mean, it's like one, you know, now I'm in my, it's where at the point that I am in my career and the kind of expertise that I have, there's sort of limits to what I'm going to be able to do. And so it's about supporting and bringing up and generating a sort of expectations and training and frameworks and funding where this kind of scholarship that should be done is being done. But, you know, I mean, even, you have experience of this sort of collaboration and co-authorship in your work with Peter Vail and Alexander Davis on the imperial discipline. And, you know, again, I think this sort of sense of collaboration and interdisciplinary work is really important.
Thanks, Patricia. I was thinking about, since you mentioned our work, how, you know, we thought about our work after reading your work, because we also silence sort of histories of women in our work. Olive Schreiner is a good case, and how Olive Schreiner was speaking to some of these, you know, mediocre Oxford men who had gone to South Africa. But in our own history, we hadn't sort of considered Olive Schreiner. So that work is also, so it's not just collaboration in terms of who we work with, but also kind of works that are speaking to each other and sort of trying to highlight the silences of each other's work. So I think that's that, in that sense, also, I think your work is great, even for people with critical sort of bent of mind. Now, one of the issues that you flag in the volumes is that the problem with working with marginalized figures is their absence in the usual archives. And you, the editors, as well as all the authors in the edited volumes, deal with it in several ways. I think there's Robbie Shillam's piece, I've exactly forgotten. Is it Street Walking?
Street Strolling.
Street Strolling, yeah. So could you tell us more about some of these methodological parts which may prove helpful for students interested in such projects? Because in the usual places, you're not going to find these women.
Well, I have to disagree with you on that. I think this is a really interesting question. Often historical women international thinkers are not absent in the archives. I'm currently doing some work on Marjorie Perham, who, you know, is easily Britain's leading thinker at the end of empire, at mid-century. She's almost completely missing in IR's intellectual disciplinary histories of this period, even those that focus on Britain. But it's not because she's missing in the archive. She left 770 boxes of papers, and her the catalogue of her papers alone is 500 pages, and the index alone to her work is 50 pages. So there's no sense in which Perham was marginalised, is marginal. She's absolutely central to understanding Britain's place in the world at the end of empire on so many levels. So, you know, we have to look for other reasons to explain her absence. And in her case, it's not only that she was a woman, but it is also the question of the relationship between end of empire and the formation of IR as a discipline in Britain. Then there are other figures like Lucy Zimmern, who she also left quite extensive papers, but they are all absorbed into her husband's papers, Alfred Zimmern. And, you know, there's enormous literature on Alfred Zimmern, one of the sort of leading early 20th century British thinkers of international relations. And you know, her papers are sort of among his, but there are about at least 2,000 papers related to Lucy Zimmern in Alfred's works. And she was a major figure in the founding and conception of the Geneva School of International Studies, which was one of the leading, you know, summer school educational projects of international relations in the interwar period. You know, I could go on. So the Agnes Headland Morley, her papers are contained within her father's. So you know, there's a range of different ways in which there are elite women who worked in elite institutions or had access to elite institutions where the papers are there and they're clearly there. And it was just a failure of IR's intellectual historians and disciplinary historians not to have consulted them. They just didn't do that work. But then there's another whole category of thinkers who don't have those sorts of archives, that sort of institutional power in the metropole. But often they were working in sort of center, you know, our project is sort of metropolitan in that sense. We focus on Britain and the United States. But in the edited volume, you know, thinkers like Jamaican Pan-Africanist Amy Ashwood Garvey, discussed by Robbie Shillam, as you mentioned. I'd also mentioned Black nationalist Mitty Maud Lena Gordon, discussed by Keisha Blaine. And in both of those cases, you know, the archival sources are more limited, but they're not totally non-existent. So, you know, I think in IR, we have a sort of tendency, I think this is, relates to what we think of as the sort of sources of theory. We, in IR, we tend to think about, and this is, this relates back to sort of this, like, this sort of fetishization of a sort of canonical thinker. It's got to be a sort of long book length treatise, dense, quite theoretical, and within some sort of ism or tradition. And that's what we think of as sort of, and that those sorts of works have sort of dominated the history of international theory and international theorizing. But in their, in the essays in the edited volume, you know, Shilliam and Blaine show in their separate ways how international thinking, international theorizing can be found in letters, self-published pamphlets, records of speeches, biographies, autobiographies, and that they have to be pieced together in a much, you know, it's much more sort of labor intensive, time consuming way. It's a much more of kind of investigative project that historians are more used to doing than, you know, IR theorists who used to just go to the library and then get like Foucault off the shelf and read all of Foucault and then like theorize around that, right? That's, or what I did in my first, I mean, my book on Hannah Arendt, you know, it was the easiest thing in the world to get her major works and read them and, you know, and so it's a sort of, this is a sort of just a different way of doing work, and it meshes. I mean, now this is the sort of, you know, IR is now having this more, we're in this phase now of a kind of historical IR period. And so, you know, I think that that has to involve more than just sweeping generalizations about the past. It has to involve taking seriously historical method, and that, you know, these are commonplaces among historians, feminist historians and historians of African-American intellectual history is a thriving field right now in the US. And, you know, these are looking at different kinds of sources to understand how people were thinking and also how they influenced thousands of other people to think about international relations, you know, through journalism, for example, and sort of not the sort of mainstream journalism, but independent press, the radical press is a great source of international thinking. And so this is really a fruitful area. But I really do want to reiterate again that, you know, the so-called marginalized figures today were often not marginal in their own time, and many left extensive archives. So that, you know, they're missing, you know, not because the because the archives are not there, but because of racist and sexist assumptions about intellectual quality, about influence, about subject.
Yeah. And staying on the methodology, could you also tell us about your own process of selection? Because I think in the anthology there, you cover like 92 women, if I'm not wrong. How did you choose and finalize the figures who eventually made it into the two books? And in what possible new directions can other researchers go?
For the edited volume, which was conceived very early on in the process, sort of also as we were putting together the Leverhulme grant, Katerina Rizzo and I thought of this as a sort of stock taking of sort of some of the work that was already being done, that there was actually already a sort of significant number of people, you know, independent separate forays that had not in some sense been brought together and into a conversation. And so since the work we've done has been enormously benefited, you know, we've enormously benefited by having it as part of this Leverhulme project, but we've also been enormously constrained by it. So the requirements of putting together a bid to a funder and been convincing them that, you know, you can do what you say you're going to do and have the expertise to do what you say you're going to do and to do it in a particular time frame, you have to limit what you're doing. And so we have a quite narrow geographical and period that we've worked within. So we also try to reach out to people who were working within that context as well. So we reached out to people we already knew, you know, who were working on women international thinkers like Glenda Sluger, Barbara Savage, and Luke Ashworth, and asked them to write like new essays, new perspectives on thinkers they had already worked on, or thinkers, or suggested thinkers that they might then turn to. And then we approached figures like Robbie Shilliam with the idea of writing on Amy Ashwood Garvey, because we thought that he might be quite interested in doing that, and he did. And so we were lucky in that, I think, you know, there wasn't anybody we didn't approach who didn't work right for the project. There was this sort of sense of excitement around it. So for the anthology, we could be more expansive in the sense of more figures within that narrow range of geographical and temporal range. And really, so that was still about limiting, it was still about limiting the fig numbers. I mean, you know, we have 104 selections to 92 different thinkers. I mean, we could have done way more. And we just started list. We just listed. I mean, you know, we've been doing a lot of our own separate work, and we just sort of list. You know, going to from our own archival work and wider reading. We just knew we had all these thinkers, and then we started just sort of compiling lists, and then of their major works, and thinking like what would work really well, and how we could organize it thematically. So. I think there was a sense of who can we not include? I mean, sorry, who can we really not include? And then do we have, you know, are there some that are kind of more representative of certain kinds of arguments, are more influential than others? And it was really just a sort of question of containing it all. I mean, it's a massive volume. I mean, it's 700 and something pages, which I think is the largest collection of international thought in print, and it's larger than the all-male, all-white text that Cambridge University published about 20 years ago. And so I think we used to like leverage that to make sure that they would not limit our word count. And so they were very supportive all the way along, and let us get away with a sort of really long tome, which I think we also like as well, because it meant that we could illustrate with the sort of heft of the text, really, you know, the sort of magnitude of the erasure and the scale of the recovery work that was only now, we're only just starting to do. So I mean, that really leads us to like what other projects can, you know, I mean, and they're not, it's not like they're following on from this project. I mean, you know, this other work, people are thinking about women international thinkers all the time around the world. I mean, you know, you mentioned your own work turned to Olive Schreiner, a leading early 20th century South African anti-colonial critic. You know, I think your work, to sort of return the compliment, has in terms of thinking about different histories, disciplinary histories around the world, in different national, imperial, colonial, international contexts, is a kind of model for how the focus on women thinkers and gender may also proceed. So a sort of collaborative project, bringing in people who actually have expertise in language, expertise, understanding of the specific contexts, to go into the archives, do the recovery work, and sort of get, you know, move the project on. And that's really exciting. I'm sure that that's happening right now. And then, you know, thinking about this podcast being sort of also directed towards students. I mean, you know, wherever you're listening to this, anywhere around the world now, go and find out the sort of history of your academic department and who were the earliest thinkers there on international relations. What were they writing? What was the context? And sort of dig in and, you know, do that work and write those essays up. I mean, this is a really exciting potential new project for students to take on.
And you already have like 92 characters to write on. I mean, I like writing biographies, and one, you know, one could put sort of any of these figures and write sort of full scale biographies on them. Most of them are sort of well forgotten. Now, I think the greatness of any project is if it sort of, you know, creates many more projects, and I think that's one of the good things about this project. And also, I think the whole dissemination, you know, through journal articles, but also through roundtables and these podcasts, this project is very well known. Could I also ask you, was it sort of a deliberate effort on your part to sort of advertise it well? Because that is the key part, I think, you know, for people to know that something like this exists. And it's entered into the common sense of discipline in such a short time. So I don't know if it was deliberate or if it...
No, that's really funny. It's a little bit embarrassing because there are many of these sort of journal fora on the project, and there's only one of them that we initiated. Yeah. All of them were invited. Right. All of them, editors, journal editors reached out to us and said, oh, you know, we think your project's really exciting. We'd like to organize a forum around it. Yeah. And the one that took the longest to actually come into fruition is the one that we initiated, which, and you have, you know, you contributed to, which is there's a forum in the journal International Theory. And that was the only one at the very beginning that I thought would be great to do. But they come from, they seem to be so many, but it's because they're partly, it's also partly, it's crossing three fields. So they're historians, have, you know, there's an H. Diplo forum coming, like there's more. and the journal, blog of the Journal of History of Ideas also invited one. And then there's been several IR ones. And then there's a Journal of Contemporary Political Theory also. And so that this maps onto the sort of three subfields of approaches in the project. So history and IR and political theory. So there's a lot, but it also speaks to the sort of interdisciplinary. And that was purposeful, the sense that we would try to speak to each of these three fields, you know, equally. And so that was purposeful. But the number of forum that we've done, it sounds very greedy. The number of forum we've done was not our intention. But we didn't say no to any just because, you know, why not? You know, it's exciting to do and to collaborate and to bring in loads of different interlocutors in debate and conversation. And, you know, most of the vast majority have been very, you know, extremely positive in their reaction. But, you know, we've also had some pointed critiques of the sort of, again, as we accept, the sort of narrow geographical and temporal scope. Even within that context, we could have done more, I think, as you pointed out, to bring in, for example, Indian women in working in London, as we have done with women of the African diaspora working in London. We just didn't, you know, have that expertise and scope for that within the project, but it's, that work is being done by others. And, you know, I'm sure that doing that would have changed the framing of our project in some different ways. We just didn't have the scope to do it.
I mean, I think it's great, especially because, like I said, it's entered into common sense of discipline. But then I also sometimes think, like, what, 4 or 5 years ago, there was nothing like this. So, and that's the question I've always wanted to ask you. Were you surprised when you started with this thing? Wow, 100 years and nothing on women in international thought? Or was it on expected lines?
I mean, I wouldn't say there was nothing. I mean, you know, there were little bits and pieces, you know. So Christine Sylvester in the 90s pointed to women's absence in disciplinary. There was a little moment of more disciplinary history writing in the 90s. And Christine Sylvester was like posing questions about that. She wasn't so much saying, you know, the women were there and I know they're there, but she was more saying pointing to the gendered way in which the field defined itself to exclude women. And Glenda Sluger's work for a number of years. So it's, you know, for historians, it's not, you know, IR, international relations was always understood as a feminized field. You know, it merges in the early 20th century, coinciding with the expansion, you know, the increasing in internationalization of the women's movement. And women's, you know, feminist groups were among the most internationalizing in that period. So, you know, the sort of international turn in history, which has been around for some time, has had a strong gender component to it. So the field was, you know, it was a new field. It was a Mickey Mouse subject, you know, so women could make their way in it, actually. I think that's part of the story that we will be telling a little bit later in the project's work coming out. So I don't know about being surprised. I think anybody who's done any work in kind of feminist history, there's a sort of process. There's a, you know, this is a really old-fashioned project in many ways. So historians, political theorists, sociologists all been done this work in their fields many years ago. And there's a similar pattern. So when we started reading around that work in preparation for putting together the project, you know, there's sort of just stages of sort of like, oh, more women. Oh, like, you know, just finding, they're just there. They are there.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a surprise to us that when we started this project that we would find hundreds of women. I mean, you know, Joanna Wood, who's doing rewriting the Disciplinary History of American IR, she has a database. I mean, she's, you know, it's hundreds and hundreds of women thinkers founding in the best funded interwar research institute in IR was founded by women as a feminist project. And then the feminist bit had to be pushed out, but that was the original idea. Right. You know, so she's got, you know, when wait till Joe's work comes out as well.
Okay. I mean, you've already mentioned a few books, I think, in the podcast, but are there any other books that you recommend to students who are interested in exploring the richness and depth of Women's International Party?
I think there are two books that are coming out next year that I'm really excited by. The first is Barbara Savage's long-awaited biography of Merz Tate. You know, Vitalis's book, White World Order, Black Power Politics, you know, recovered these sort of thinkers of the Howard School. And Merz Tate was sort of one of, you know, one of the most interesting in, of those groups. And, you know, she was the only one of those five in the Howard School that didn't have their own biographer. And that also was the first book in our, in an IR context that actually did archival work on a woman. Well, Barbara Savage, who, you know, and well, Merz Tate has really found her biographer with Barbara Savage. And I've read some early essays in terms of from this research, and one of them appears in the edited volume. And this is going to be a sort of major study of one of the most interesting and important international relations thinkers of the 20th century. And that's so exciting. And to have a thinker of that significance with a biographer of that skill. So I'm really excited by that. And the second book is, and that, so Barbara Savage's book is coming out with Yale University Press at some point in 2023. And early in 2023, with Oxford University Press, is Geoffrey Field's biography of Elizabeth Wiskman, who, like Tate, was a prolific writer on international relations in the mid-century, early to long mid-20th century. But she was really traversed the worlds of journalism and academe. Tate was really an academic, and she stayed within academe. Wiskman is one of these figures who, like many in the British context in particular, began as journalists and then went into academe quite late. So she was actually the first Montague Burton. She was a Montague Burton Professor of International Relations at the University of Edinburgh towards the end of her career. And she was a thinker of European international relations. She was a sort of historian by training and a Europeanist, whereas Tate, you know, was a thinker of race and geopolitics and empire, in many ways, I think perhaps more interesting than Elizabeth Wiskman, but Wiskman is an important figure nonetheless. And so both of those books, I can't wait to see out.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much, Patricia. It's been such a pleasure. And thanks for inspiring us with your ideas and works. Thanks very much again.
Thank you. It was lovely to talk with you. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.